So this six parshas, Parshas Truma, will begin on page 444. Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe lemar, Hashem said to Moshe, saying, Daber al b'nei Yisrael, speak to the Jewish people, vayikchu li truma, and let them take for me a portion, me'eis kol ish asher yedvenu libay, from every man whose heart motivates him, tikchu es truma, see you shall take my portion. So here is where Moshe tells the Jewish people to donate towards the construction of the Mishkan. And the famous question that's asked is the fact that the message is v'yikchu li truma, which means that they should take for me a portion. And the real way to have said it should have been, and they shall give a portion. By take for me a portion. Okay, famous question. And the answer to the question is typically are working around the realm of, because when you give tzedakah, you're not just giving, but you're taking because of the personal gain or the growth that you have from it. So I'm going to share with you a similar answer to that, but as part of a very interesting comment that Rabbi Yisrael Reisman, he's a very prominent Rav in Flatbush, said from his Rebbe, Rav Aram Pam, the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshiva Tar Vadas. And Rav Pam spoke about two different types of tzedakah givers. For the discussion, I'm going to add a third. Okay, three types of people who give tzedakah. You've got the person who gives tzedakah because he sees a need and he wants to fill the need. There's a need out there. There's a person who needs. There's a family who needs. There's a yeshiva that needs. An organization that needs. There's a need. And he wants to fill that need. He wants to take care of that need. Definitely seems to be a exemplary attitude. Then you've got the person who gives tzedakah for the honor. You know, why does he give the money? Because he wants his name on the building. He wants the recognition. That is clearly a situation of giving tzedakah for the sake of personal honor. Now, Rav Pam then talks about a third level. Which is a very interesting perspective. And that is that you'll have a person who, let's say, is going to donate to a yeshiva. Not because he's motivated by what he sees the yeshiva needs. But his motivation is the fact that he wants a part of what's going on here. This yeshiva is there are people, there are many, many students studying Torah at a high level. There's something important going on here. There's something very important and real going on here. And he wants to be a part of it. And the way he knows he can be a part of it is by supporting it. So the focus is not because yeshiva has a need. The focus is because I want to be part of this.
Yes, indeed.
But the thing is like this. The way I understand it is, quality has a need. But again, is when he says, I want to be part of it, is it because, again, it's something selfish, I want to get all the reward of their learning? Is that the need? Or it's not that, or it could be nobler than that. And that is that he sees something very noble, very holy, very important that's going on, and he wants to be part of it. He wants to be part of it. He wants a part of it. He wants a portion of it. Not because of the fact necessarily in the sense of, oh, the tremendous reward that you can get from it. But when there's something very noble that strikes you, something very noble that you feel for, that you connect with, you want to be part of it. And in essence, yeah, it is something for him. He wants to be part of it. But it's not he wants to be part of it because of personal gain as much as wanting to be part of something great, of something noble. And Rav Pam says that from the way he says it here, he feels that's the highest level. The highest level is not just to be motivated because somebody's missing something. The highest level is to understand how noble and holy and important this is, and you want to be part of it. And therefore, he says, Rav Reisman takes this to the point of understanding as to why the pasuk used the word v'yikchu li truma, take for me a truma. Because the Torah is trying to allude to the idea of that when you're donating towards the Mishkan, you receive something from it. What are you receiving from it? You're receiving from it the fact that you can be part of this very noble cause. You can be part of this very holy endeavor. Understand that when you're giving towards this, the way you should be, this is the way I interpret it, what was said, the way I would say it. The pasuk is using, the Torah uses the word v'yikhu to impart this idea that the way you should be giving this tzedakah, the way you should be giving towards the Mishkan, is in a way of giving, in a way that you're receiving. Because the way you're giving is, you want to be part of something. You're not just giving because you want to fill a need. So I plug the hole, fine, it's a nice thing to do. But it's not just about plugging the hole. It's about you're receiving something from this. What are you receiving? The fact that you're part of this holy endeavor. Now, you know, what I started thinking about with this was, and it was actually because of something that Rabbi Reisman said in the Shir, was the fact that, you know, was giving to the Mishkan, so to speak, automatically this form of giving to be part of something? Could someone have looked at the Mishkan and seen it as filling a hole, filling a need?
Well, they never had it before, so it would have been hard to...
They never had it before, but can you say, you know, Hashem needs a home? But to me, it seems that, look, at the end of the day, right, the Mishkan had to be built. Right? Hashem doesn't need a home, but whatever purpose the Mishkan is, it's got to be built. So that seems to be a need. So the thing is, and therefore, I would just take this idea that Rav Pam said and say that the Torah is trying to allude to that you should be giving in the form of that you're taking, that you're receiving, and it's this idea.
Could you have a need also?
Okay. So now the thing is like this. I want to ask you a question, and I just thought about it this year. I don't know if it's an appropriate question. Okay. So, as you just said, the Jewish people needed to build the Mishkan. Really? They got the man from Shemayim. They got their water. Their man was a miracle. The water was a miracle. Their protection was a miracle. They were living a miraculous life. So really, you have to build the Mishkan? Hashem can send one down. Like we're waiting for when the third Beis HaMikdash comes. I don't know if it's an appropriate question, but it's like, you know, it kind of strikes you with everything else that's going on. Hashem, why do you need to build a Mishkan?
It's like you're a wealthy man, you have everything, and building a shul.
Yeah, but it is. But that's because you're living in a natural world. If you're living in a supernatural world, like they were basically, mm-hmm. everything else they had was coming through a miracle, so why couldn't the Mishkan come through a miracle?
All the water and the mud and whatever, the food was for them, more versus for Hashem, so that's a little difference. Mishkan is...
But why should that make... Well, first of all, it's not for Hashem. It's for them, primarily. It's to have a place for Hashem, to have a Shekhinah, but again, it's not for Hashem, it's for us.
It's a meeting place.
It's for us. Yeah, it's for us. So if that is an appropriate question, then the answer could very well be this idea. The idea here is not to have it as a miracle because you should want to have a part in this. But what I was also thinking, again, if this question is an appropriate question as to why the Mishkan can come down as a miracle, and perhaps the answer is that the message in that is that your physical needs, Hashem says, you know, there could be a point where I'll take care of that, but your spiritual needs, you have to do that. You have to put the effort into your spiritual needs. You can't. Spiritual needs don't come from a gift from Hashem. You have to put in the effort. And therefore, even if everything else could come through a miracle, the Mishkan couldn't. Because your spiritual needs, your the way you grow close to Hashem, for that, you have to be involved. Okay. Now, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I have at least...
Is this related to this or a different kind of question?
In English text, no, it's sort of not quite, but it's related to the sentence. In English, at least, the way it's written here, Hashem is speaking to Moshe and tell him, you
take, speak to the Jewish people
and you take
from, not you take from that, yeah. no the yikhu, speak to the Jewish people the yikhu, and they shall take
all
to me
take from you. Okay.
Okay, now Rav Pam continues with this idea to explain another famous medrash, And this medrash is not mentioned this week's parsha. It's more later on in Vayakob Kudei or in Kisisa, but it's later on. And that is that the Nesiim, the princes of the Jewish people, there's a medrash that says that they said, let everybody donate first the materials. And whoever's missing, we will give. And that was a big mistake on their part because they gave everything to the point that they had nothing left to give. And because of that, the Torah leaves out a letter from the word Nesiim to show that this idea that they had was not correct. And a lot of the commentaries ask, well, what exactly was wrong? Can you imagine if somebody would tell to a yeshiva, look, you try to raise what you can for the budget, and I'll take care of the rest. You know, people would say that's pretty good. So what was wrong here? So Rav Ham says that according to this, we can say that if your attitude about giving tzedakah is to fill a need, then you'll say, okay, let them take care of the need to some degree, and I'll take care of the rest of the need. But if your attitude is that you want to be part of something, then that you're not going to do that. If you want to be part of something big, you want to be part of it, you do it. It's not about taking care of the need afterwards. The answer, a common answer to this question was, but they should have done it anyway. If they were excited to do the mitzvah, they should do it anyway. So Rav Pam is saying it in the sense of, if your attitude about giving tzedakah is because you want to be part of something, then you don't wait to say, well, I'll wait to make up for everybody else. You want to be part of it. You want to be part of this great endeavor. You want to be part of something bigger. You do it.
But if you look at somebody giving to yeshiva, somebody may say, well, let them give, if they have everything, and give to another yeshiva that they won't.
Well,
give
that could be too. But here the point was, that wasn't the point here. Here the point was, it was the one Mishkan.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So again, this would explain the wording of the parsha. Ve'yikholi truma, they will take unto me truma, because we're trying to include the word taking to imply to them the idea of giving the tzedakah to receive, because you become part, because you want to be part of something very great. Okay, let's take a look now on page 446. This is the discussion where the Torah talks about the construction of the Aron, of the Ark. So, page 446, Pasuk Yud. V'asu Aron atzei shitim. They shall make an ark of shitim wood. Amasayim v'chetzi arkai. 2.5 amas is its length. V'ma v'chetzi rachbay. 1.5 its width. V'ma v'chetzi kamasai. 1.5 its height. They shall cover it with pure gold, from the inside and the outside it shall be covered, and they'll make a golden crown all around. So the pasuk says that the Aron is made by covering the inside and the outside with gold, which Rashi explains means that the Aron was actually three boxes. The outer box was gold, the inner box was wood, and the one inside, that one was gold. That's what it means to cover the inside and the outside. The Gemara takes the Aron, the Ark, and it brings out certain rebuzzim, certain allusions that the Ark is meant to bring out. The Ark, the Aron Kai, the Aron holds the Luchas, held the tablets, which means the Aron held the Torah. And the Aron holding the Torah is actually meant to allude to a Talmud Chacham, to a Torah scholar, who holds the Luchas within himself, who holds the Torah within himself. And the fact that the Torah says that the Ark is supposed to be gold on the inside and the outside is telling us that Kol Talmud Chacham, any Torah scholar, Shein Toichei Kabaroi, that his inside is not like his outside, Ein Talmud Chacham, isn't considered a Torah scholar. What does that mean? His inside is not like his outside. Means a Torah scholar who appears in a certain way on the outside, but in the inside he's not really that person that he portrays himself on the outside. That's not a Torah scholar. That means if you have a Torah scholar that seems to represent or teach certain concepts, and he doesn't really live up to those concepts, okay, that's not a Torah scholar. And that was alluded to in the fact that the Ark was gold on the inside and the outside. You have to be gold on inside and the outside. You've got to be the same on the inside and the outside, which means you have to be real. You have to be sincere. The idea of do what I say and don't do what I do is unacceptable. Now, if you think about it, this kind of a concept is really relevant not just to a Torah scholar, it's relevant to anybody. Right? You should always be sincere. You should always be living up to what you believe. You shouldn't just be acting in a certain way on the outside, but inside, not being that way, or acting in a certain way and then contradicting yourself. So I heard a story from that was said by Rav Moshe Tuvia Leaf. He's a prominent rabbi in Flatbush. And he tells the following story. He was a student of the Telz Yeshiva in Cleveland. And his Rebbe was a Rav Mordechai Gifter Zatzal, the Rosh Yeshiva. And he had a friend, and his name, I believe, was Mordechai Schneider, who, as a young man, passed away from cancer. And when he became sick, you know, he went for treatments, chemo treatments, and then afterwards he'd come back to yeshiva when he could. So there was one time he came back after a very difficult treatment, and the Rosh Yeshiva noticed that he was very down. Very, very down. So he said to his student, he said, Mordechai, what's the problem? Why do you look so sad? So he told him, he said, I am completely exhausted, and I'm emotionally drained. Why? Because one of the oncologists that he met said to him, you're an Orthodox Jew. I have no respect for Orthodox Jews because Orthodox Jews are intolerant. And that took a lot out of him when that person said that to him. So Rav Gifter responded and made the following point. There are certain people who tolerate ideals but not people. And then there are people who don't tolerate ideals, but they tolerate people. Which means, you can have a person who has these high ideals, right, about how people should be treated and how people should be dealt with. But when they come into a situation of friction with someone, are they still that tolerant? Are they still that nice? Are they still that right? You know, is everything that they espouse, the ideals that they espouse, they don't necessarily translate into their interaction with other people. A Torah Jew has ideals that he cannot tolerate. He can't tolerate them. They're not acceptable. But he's supposed to tolerate the person who may have those ideals. Meaning, there are certain times, there are certain ideals that aren't tolerable. You know? If you hear somebody talking about how living a Jewish life is worthless and unacceptable and not valuable or things like that, you know, that's not a tolerable attitude. But when you come into dealing with that person, can you tolerate him? A perfect example of this, I feel, is Rofe. Rofe International. Our Rofe International, the Boston Rebbe. Right, any Jew who comes into that comes to Rofe is taken care of 100%. It doesn't make a difference if you're religious, if you're irreligious, right? There, I have no question, and I'm not trying to knock anyone, that there have been some secular Israeli Jews who are very anti-religious who have landed up in Rofe and have been taken care of like anybody else, right? Do we feel that their attitudes are correct? Do we feel that those certain attitudes that they may have are tolerable? The attitudes are intolerable. The ideals aren't tolerable. But we tolerate these people. In when he told this story about Leaf, he didn't make this comment. But when I heard this story, my initial reaction was, you have a thing against Orthodox Jews not being tolerant. But that's how you could talk to someone who is in the middle of chemo? He's here for chemo treatment. He's taking chemo. That's what you say to him?
He's a doctor, the other guy?
He's an oncologist.
Oncologist.
The oncologist, right, says this to a person. He's complaining about, you're the type of person not tolerant, but that's how you talk to a person with cancer taking chemo? It's unbelievable.
So maybe
what? The idea is that this is an example of a person who is will espouse ideals, fight for those ideals, march for those ideals. Tell somebody else off who doesn't believe those ideals, but what about who the other person is? Is there something about the person? So there is always, we always have to make sure that, you know, what we espouse and what we represent and what we show and what we teach, that we're living up to it. We're not contradicting ourselves. So the question can be asked, so why is the Gemara only talking about the Talmud Chacham? Talmud Chacham is inside Shmuel like is outside. Everybody's inside Shmuel like they're outside. But the answer is simple. The Gemara is trying to say, number one, especially a Talmud Chacham, because of the sample, because of the way people look at him. But number two, another way of saying it is, you know, we can imagine that you could have a certain kind of person who's extremely learned. Now, does he live up 100% to the way he should be? Maybe not. But he's a Talmud Chacham. He's a Torah scholar. Look how much he knows. Okay, so he's not 100%. He doesn't do everything right. But look what he knows and look what he has to say. You know, he's a Talmud Chacham. No, he's not a Talmud Chacham. Gemara is saying. He's not a Talmud Chacham. If he's not Teicha Gabar, if he's not sincere, then you cannot truly attribute to him the title of Talmud Chacham. So we're all supposed to be sincere. We're all supposed to be genuine. But the Gemara is trying to say that don't think a person who is so knowledgeable but is not living up to that idea of being genuine can have that title. That title does not go, no matter how learned you are and how well you teach and how many good ideas you espouse. If you're not genuine, you cannot carry that title. But again, it's an idea, though, that we all have to live up to. In the sense that we very often are trying to give certain ideals to our children, to our friends, to our society. And no one's going to be perfect. But the point is that you have to be genuine in the sense that you shouldn't be like, you know, walking the walk, but not, or I'm not, talking, you know, living the idea of do what I say, but don't do what I do.
The problem is also, even further, this person represents all of us who are supposed to be orthodox, whatever.
Okay.
So it's like, you know, when they see him, it affects people's thoughts of the
okay.
person.
Okay. All right, let's now move on, and let's go to okay, this is going to be page 452. Perek Chavav Pasuk Aleph. Okay, and we're going to read through a part of the parsha that deals with describing the construction of a certain part of the Mishkan, of the tabernacle. And I don't have any pictures, but hopefully, you know, we'll be able to follow what's going on. So this is Pasuk Aleph. Es Hamishkan Ta'asa Eser Yerios. Now, when the word Mishkan here is used, it's not referring to the whole edifice that we call the Mishkan, the tabernacle. It's actually referring to a covering, right? The tabernacle had walls, actually made out of beams, right? It had the contents inside, an ark, a mizbeach, a menorah. And then it had, what was the roof? What was the roof made out of? The answer is, the roof was made out of certain coverings, material coverings. So the Mishkan, when it says here, "Es haMishkan Tasa," you shall make the Mishkan, it's actually, as they translate it, you shall make the tabernacle spread. It was a covering over the Mishkan. Okay? So, "Es haMishkan Tasa Es Yerios." The Mishkan covering you shall make out of 10 panels. "Sheish Mashzar," these panels are made out of twisted flax, "Utsachelis," turquoise wool, "Vargaman," and purple wool, "Vatelashani," and red wool, "Keruvim Asei Chayshev," angels, the work of an artist, meaning the image of angels would actually be woven into these panels. "Maisei Chayshev Sayisa Isam," the work of an artist shall you make them. "Oirech Hayiri Ha'achas," the length of one panel. "Shmoina Ve'esrim Ba'ama," 28 amas long. "V'roichav," how wide is each panel? "Arba ba'ama," 4 amas wide. "Bayira achas," but this is the measurements for one panel. Mida achas achal ha-yiriyos. And all the yiriyos, all the panels, are the same size. Chamesh ha-yiriyos tiyena chavreis isha la-chaisa. Five panels shall be connected one to the other. Rashi says they were sewn together. They were made as separate panels, and then the panels were sewn together. V'chamesh riyos chayvresh isha l'chaysa, and then you had another five panels that were connected one to the other. Now, v'asisa lulois techeles, you shall make loops out of turquoise wool, alsfas hayriyah achas, at the edge of one of the panels, mikatsa b'chayvares, that's at the end of one of the groups. The show shall you do at the edge of the panel, again, that is the most outer one in the second connection. So basically, you've got these two groups of five panels, and at the end of each one of the groups, at the edge of one of the outer panels, you had these loops that were put on. 50 loops shall you make on one panel. And another 50 loops you shall make at the edge of the panel of the second group. The loops are opposite each other. Okay? Now, you shall make 50 golden hooks. You will then connect these panels that have the loops one to the other with the hooks. V'hayah mishkan echad, and now the mishkan spread will be one. You get that? So you've got basically you start up with five panels, sew them together at the edges of each one of the groups, make loops, take these hooks, which I'm going to assume were probably S hooks, right? And you put them into the loops, and that's how you connect them all. Okay? Now, what we should ask here at this point is, let's say the pasuk would have said, make the 50 hooks and connect the panels, each one to the other. Would it have to say, and the mishkan will be one? If they're all connected together, right? If five and five are connected together, and they connect them with hooks, they're one, aren't they? What exactly is the Torah trying to add when it says, and the mishkan will be one? I mean, it seems to be automatic. It seems to be self-understood. Now, let's read it a little bit further, because we're going to need this further for another comment that we're going to have. Now, so you've got the mishkan spread that's basically on top of the beams that made the walls. Now, you're going to make yirios izim. You're going to make panels out of goat hair lo'ayel ala mishkan, to spread on top of the Mishkan spread. It's a second spread on top of the Mishkan spread. Ashley Esri Yiriyos Tasa Oisam. They're made out of 11 panels. Oirech Hayriya Achas. The length of one panel, Shloishim Ba'ama. 30 amas long. That means you've got two amas bigger for each panel. Okay? V'roich of Arba Ba'ama Hayriya Ha'achas. The width of each panel is 4 amas, the same as before. Mida achas lashtei esrei yiriyos, one measure again for all 11 panels. The chibartes chamesh yiriyos levad, v'sheish yiriyos levad. Then connect five panels together, separate, and then six panels together, separate. Meaning each one, you sew five together, and then you sew six together. Now, the chafaltes yiriyah hashishis, and you're going to double over the sixth panel, el mul pnei amenorah, over the face of the tent, meaning when you lay it out, right, that extra sheet is going to be folded over and it's going to be hanging over the opening of the Mishkan. You're going to make 50 loops. At the end of one of the panel, at one end. And another 50 at the edge of the other, of the edge of the last panel on the other, of the other group. You're going to make 50. This time the hooks are made out of brass. The chayshes, the hevesa or copper, the same thing.
Yeah, well, brass is a mixture of metals, but copper is just a metal.
Because sometimes I see the word nechoshes as translated as brass, and sometimes as copper.
Yeah, brass is copper or something else. So.
Okay. Ve'veses akros sabalu la'ois, and you shall bring the hooks into the loops. V'chibartes ha'oyel v'hoye echad, and you shall connect the oyel, and it shall be one. Same thing as before. Okay? So again, the same question. Why? What is the Torah trying to bring out with the words of v'hoye echad? So, I want to share with you a halachic question that is brought down in the Trumas Hadeshin. The Trumas Hadeshin, the author of Trumas Hadeshin, lived in the 15th century. And his responsa are, you know, very, 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 very important and well studied. So he has the following question. It's a shotless question. We know there's a prohibition of having a garment made out of wool and linen, okay, that are connected, that are connected together.
Well, so the for humans wearing.
Yeah.
But not necessarily for this.
I didn't say that. Now, so the question that was put to the Trumas Hadeshin is the following. You have this kind of a shirt, okay? The shirt is made out of linen, okay? Now, it seems in the good old days, you know, the shirts didn't come with long sleeves, I guess, right? You have to attach the sleeves to the, I don't know if it's a vest or a shorter sleeves, whatever it may be. And the sleeves are made out of wool, and the way they were connected was with buttons. They weren't sewn, not talking about sewn together, but with buttons. Is that a problem of shotness or not? Is a question that was put to the Trumas Hadeshin. The Trumas Hadeshin said, basically, that if the way the buttons are in is that they're so loose that with your hand you can take them apart, that's not called a connection. That's not called a connection. That's not a connection. That's not a strong enough connection. Brings different proofs about what kind of connection. You know, he says it doesn't have to be sewn, but you need what's called a kesher. A knot would work also. But a knot is a strong connection. A knot is not something you could just take apart. Right? So therefore he says that the buttons, if they could just be taken apart, is not considered a connection. And then he asks from the pasuk that we just read. The pasuk we just read, he says, let me just find it. Va'af agav dechsiv, and even though it's written in the Torah, ve'heveisa es akrasim alula ois, you shall bring the hooks into the loops, ve'chibarta es oyel, and you shall connect the oyel. You shall connect it. Alma mikri chibar dechrasim. If the Torah says v'chibart, you'll connect. So you see that a connection can be a connection just with hooks. If the hooks are just a connection, the button should never be a connection. So he says like this, ikala meimar, you could say, shahayu asuyin b'inyan zeh. Those hooks were done in the following way. Shalo yishmatu klal lo yedei maisa. They couldn't come apart without doing some kind of act of taking them apart. Kugoyim shahayu kaifefeha Rashi Hakeres Lagamri Letzida Nashenis. Basically, they didn't just put the hooks there. After the S hook was put in, they bent it right, so that it actually couldn't come apart unless you sawed it off or something or another like that. So therefore, although there's no mention of that, it just says bring the hooks. But he's saying if the Torah is calling it a chibur, the Torah is calling it a connection. So then that means that it's something, has to be something strong. It can't be something you can just take apart. So what did they do? That must have been that they bent the hook in a way that it wouldn't come up, that you can't just take it apart. And therefore he says, you know what? If you make the buttons, right? But after you make the buttons, you sew up the holes so tight that you can't just take it apart, then you're right, it's going to be shotless. But if all you do is just leave it with the buttons, it's not shotless. So the Shemesh Hadeshin just gave us an understanding of this pasuk. Give us an understanding of what was actually done when they connected it with those hooks. They didn't just hook it together. They actually took the hooks and they bent the hooks over in a way that they couldn't come apart.
And then it became one.
So even though here it sounds like, well, he asked a question, the word chibarta is what he focuses on. But perhaps the point is that if it wouldn't say v'ha'yakeechad, perhaps you could have thought that chibarta doesn't have to be so strong. V'ha'yakeechad, not, you've got to connect it that it should be one.
Permanently.
should be one. That's how Rabbi Reisman uses this Truma Sadeshin to answer the question. So it's a very interesting question, and it's very, very, very geschmack. Okay, now let's just read it a little further before we can have our last comment. All right. So far we have the Mishkan. Right. We've got the walls of the Mishkan. We've got the Mishkan spread, and over that we have the Ezim spread. We have the goat hair spread. Okay. And then the Pesukim talk about how basically, you know, if one is 28 and one is 30, there's going to be, you know, part of the covering that's going to cover over and extend further, because that actually would cover the rest of the would cover the bottom of the beams. And then the pasuk talks about, if you take a look, we'll skip a few pesukim and look at the pasuk Yud David, verse 14. V'asisa michse le'oyel. Now you're going to make a cover for the tent. You're going to make a cover for the second spread. Made out of what? Oyreis elim adamim, made out of ram skin that is dyed red. Umichse oyreis techashim amala. And on top of that, you have another cover that's made out of tachash skin. Tachash was a certain type of animal. We don't have to get into that right now. Okay? The Rashi explains that these are called covers. And that means is that it was really, it didn't, these covers didn't drape over. Like how we had, you had the Mishkan and you had the Mishkan spread, and you have the oil, the urea made out of goat hair that spreads over it. But then only on the roof is where you had these other covers. Some say it was two covers, some say it was one cover made out of both. But the point is that all you have is these this last thing mentioned was not draped over the side, it was just on top. Okay. So here, Shimon Schwab had a very interesting comment based on this whole setup. There is a pasuk in the book of Micha. Micha is part of Treyaser. And there is a pasuk in Micha that says like this. Okay. So the prophet Micha said, Higid lecha adam atayv. Hashem has already told you, man, what is good. Ma Hashem derish memcha, what Hashem asks of you, demands of you. Ki matzayis mishpat, he wants you to do justice, vavas chesed, and love kindness. Vatzneya leches imeloi kecha. Walk with tznius, walk with humility, walk with modesty before Hashem. Okay. So, what does that mean, to walk modestly before Hashem? So, one explanation that's given is, walk modestly before Hashem means walk modestly in fear of God. Okay. So, you're walking modestly with God. You're walking with God, you're with God, and you're doing so in a modest manner. So, you think about it, though, the words read, Hatzneya leches imalekecha, walk modestly with your God. Does that imply that God is also modest? I think you could explain it as to mean, you know, walk modestly, that's you, with God. But Rashi has a second explanation that would imply an interpretation that is saying that the tznius, that you're walking modestly, is because Hashem is that way too. You're walking with God modestly. He goes modestly and you go modestly. How is that? Davar Acher, Rashi says, Vasnei leches loy, and walk modestly. Loy k'midas HaKadosh Baruch Hu k'midas Basar V'Adam. Hashem doesn't do things like people do it. Midas Basar V'Adam, when it comes to people, Adam Avayishas Chaveray. Reuven embarrassed Shimon. Uba l'faisay. And now Reuven wants to come to apologize. V'oymer loy, so Shimon says to him, Eini misratzalach, I am not going to forgive you. You embarrass me in front of those two people. I am not going to forgive you until you bring those two people here that you embarrassed me in front of, and you apologize to me in front of them. Meaning, it's like, you embarrassed me publicly, now you're going to apologize publicly. Like, you embarrassed me publicly, I'm going to embarrass you publicly. You know, you're going to get the same thing. You're going to have to apologize publicly. You're going to have to go through the shame publicly also. Aval Kadosh Baruch Hu ein chafetz ela sheyashav elav ben ela ben atzmai. When it comes to you making up with Hashem, Hashem says, you can do it privately. You can do it privately, just between me and you. Okay, so the point is that, but the way Rashi is now bringing this, this is seemingly a medrash, to explain, go modestly with Hashem, is that the Pasuk is alluding to the idea that Hashem will act modestly too. And the example given is that Hashem doesn't, you know, doesn't demand that when you apologize, that, you know, he puts it out in the public, like how people want to do that sometimes. So it would sound like from Rashi that the pasuk is alluding to the idea of Hashem going modestly. Now the word tznius is usually a word that we translate as modesty, but we typically use it in the sense of clothing. Of how much, you know, how much we cover ourselves. It's really the idea of not being showy. Whatever it may be what we're talking about. Not being showy. Being humble. Being modest. So Rav Shimon Schwab said, where do we see this in Hashem? So Rashi brings down an example. Rav Shimon Schwab said that there's a very obvious place where we see Hashem's tznius, Hashem's modesty. Take a look at the Mishkan. Okay? The menorah. You read about how the menorah was built. It was a work of art. Solid gold. Beautiful piece of work. Anything that's made of solid gold must be impressive. You've got the ark, you've got the shulchan. But you, and some of these things had intricate designs on them. It really must have been something beautiful to see. And who got to see it? Nobody besides the Kohanim. There's a Gemara that says that when Jewish people would come to Anyantif, they'd let them see the menorah. But typically, it wasn't seen. Okay? The walls of the Mishkan, right? Who saw them? Again, the Kohanim who came inside saw them. But on the outside, they're completely covered. Now, if you talk about the Mishkan cover, which was made out of turquoise wool and purple wool and red wool, right? Sounds nice. Sounds like something nice to see. You don't see that either. What do you see? The goat hair covering. You know, I can imagine that probably was something decent, neat, but was it that pretty? You know? So everything in the Mishkan was made, all the beauty of the Mishkan was kept very private. It wasn't out there for everything to see. It wasn't showed out. It wasn't there on exhibit. Everything was covered. It was, you know, the beauty that's there is not on display. It's not to be exhibited. It's there. It's there, and it's there to be seen in very specific, under very specific conditions. That's Hashem's tznius. That's Hashem being tznu, Hashem being modest. Where the place where he has his divine presence is not shown off for all its beauty. On the contrary, its beauty is covered. Its beauty is protected. And that teaches us the idea that when it comes to that, we're not meant to be on display, whatever it may be. We're not meant to be on display. Whatever we have in the sense of beauty, of physical beauty, or whatever kind of physical presence that there may be, it's not meant to be on display. It's there. It exists. It's there to be in certain conditions to be seen and to be appreciated, but it's not out on display. And that is what the whole setup of the Mishkan brought out. That's what it means. That's Ne'alech Simulekach, Rav Schwab said. Walk humbly, walk with modesty, with Hashem. Follow Hashem's example of tznius. Follow Hashem's example of modesty and the fact that his beautiful Mishkan, all that beauty, was not an exhibit. It was all kept private. Just want to conclude with an interesting explanation to a custom. In a lot of shuls, they collect tzedakah, right, to go around with the pushka, during Pesukah de Zimra, meaning before Yishtabach, by the section of Ayavorech David. And that's a minig Arizal I saw brought down. Reisman brings that as a minig Arizal. what's pshat? Like, why do you collect tzedakah then? So it's very interesting. I mean, if you learn Tanakh, you could have a, you could, the answer is kind of right there. But by Yivarech David is actually from Divrei Hayamim, from the Book of Chronicles 1. And before David HaMelech says this blessing to Hashem, he makes a very public announcement saying that, you know, Shlomo is going to be king. He's going to build a Beis HaMikdash. Hashem said, I can't. And basically, I have donated lots of money material for it. And he basically invites others to do so. And they do so. And after they do so, and they do so with a full heart, the Pasuk says, Vayivarech David, David gave a blessing. So David's blessing followed when people donated, when people gave tzedakah. And therefore, it becomes a time, therefore the meaning became that that's a time for giving tzedakah, because David's bracha came after people gave tzedakah, and therefore there is a custom, rather, to give tzedakah at that point.
But usually when